Well, a familiar face has returned to the historic Park City Alliance. Allison Kulo back as executive director of the organization. She joins me now in the studio to talk about what she hopes to accomplish here in round two. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Yeah, so when you left, Michael Brill came in and served for a few years. I mean, why was it something you wanted to do again?
Right. So I left the organization in September of 2016. Michael did take the role from that point, and then we swapped again. and I just took over the role about 2 weeks ago. So for me, I went through, I think, a lot of growth and development in my professional life over the last 3 years. I went and obtained a master's degree from Gonzaga in organizational leadership, worked with a lot of local nonprofits on consulting, whether it be management structure to strategic planning. And when this position came open again, I was excited to look at it through a new lens. Not only am I looking at it differently, but also there's a big change on the street. There's new businesses. There is a different board. The makeup is a lot more newer businesses. And then as well, the economy has strengthened over the past 3 years. So I feel like while I am walking back into the same job and I know some of the same things that I'm going to be doing, I really feel like I need to take some time over the next 2 months and really look at what has changed and what are people excited to see or what do they need to see.
Yeah. So is it still just a part-time position?
It is. Yeah, it's still a part-time executive director. We have two support staff and then Misha Lawson assists us with marketing.
All right. So it sounds like I was going to ask you, have the faces or the issues changed? It sounds like some of the faces have, but...
Yeah. No, and for sure, for me, I mean, my previous 6 years with the organization, there were a lot of people I had known from the late 90s, as well as, you know, you started to see some newer businesses. Now, I think it's more fresh faces on the board. You still have the input that you hope to seek from those that have been on the street for a long time, but it's a new energy. And so really trying to take their temperature and seeing what their needs are.
Yeah. We spoke with the executive director of the Park City Sunday Market, Shanine, for the 13th season, really another great year. And one of the ongoing issues, though, has certainly been dealing with the merchants of Main Street. Is your organization still talking about that?
Absolutely. So the Silly Market, their contract is up for renewal, and that is one piece that we want to be able to seek input from the merchants and understand how those Sundays are working for them. One thing that I have come to understand is the desire to want to increase pedestrian traffic up the street, so all the way up to the brew pub. That was something that we've looked at multiple years, but how do you continue to keep that energy and that vibrancy that Silly Market does bring and bring it up the street? Is that the way to go, or are there other impacts that are causing it to be more detrimental than it has in the past, and do we want to try to address new issues within that? So definitely want it to be able to get all that put together by the end of this year so that we can go into that round and provide the city with our feedback.
Yeah, Silly Market, though, Sam, I mean, they've been working on this for 13 years. They have come up with lots of different ideas, and it seems like every time they present something, then it's like, you know, they'll try something, but, you know, there's so many different personalities to involve in it. It's like, who do you answer to?
Absolutely, and I think that's where you have to be careful, because you can't break it if it's working for some and not for others, and so then how do you enhance it? I do agree. We've tried lots of different options. Maybe it's time to try those again. You know, it has been probably 9 years since we've tried some more vibrancy, bringing that up to the top of the street. So let's try that again. We had done, back in the day, a swap where we had brought it up to the top of the street. I don't think that was a solution. But again, let's think outside of the box. I know that Kate and Michelle are out-of-the-box thinkers, and so I'm not afraid that we won't come up with some new ideas, but we have to run those past the merchants and see what they think.
Yeah, and one of the opportunities, I mean, something that the city council allowed for was sidewalk sales on Sundays. I mean, are merchants taking advantage of that? Do they work? Or
yeah, in the past, and I apologize, I don't know for the last 3 years, but we'd have about 20 merchants that would sign up for sidewalk sales, and we did an umbrella permit, making that super easy. And I believe that process would still remain in place as of this summer. And so that'd be something that we continue to look at.
Yeah. And Kate McChesney, the executive director, also told us that she has always been willing to talk to any merchant who wants to talk to her. I mean, are they taking advantage of her? Or of that opportunity, taking advantage of that opportunity to talk to her. Because, I mean, it's like, I think she kind of goes into these meetings that you guys have and is kind of maybe stunned that it's like, well, nobody told me, right?
So, no, agreed. And so it's looking at how do we maintain that feedback throughout the entire period and not just have it at one time of year and then it's either a shock or it's something, a larger hurdle that we have to get over. I know that there have been merchants who have individually worked with the Silly Market and have seen success. When they are able to talk individually to the Silly Market, they can come up with more individual solutions for that business. So that is something I would definitely encourage. And that is a question that would be great to ask when someone does ask, you know, mention that they're not seeing a benefit from it. You need to ask what they've been doing and understand, are there some steps that they can do that's not super overwhelming, additional cost, needing additional staff that can turn this around?
Yeah. It's been interesting, though, because I know one merchant down towards the end of the street did just kind of a straw poll walking up the street. Didn't have anything. You know, people seemed to be excited, and that we're seeing some increased visits from those from the market. And then, again, we hear from kind of this phantom merchant that says that's not the case. And it's like, we don't know who to believe. I mean, do we need to do some kind of scientific poll?
You know, I don't know if we have to be scientific. I think consistency is big and making sure that people know when during the planning process they can talk about things. And then are we following up with them during the event? Are we following up with them, you know, the first few weeks, mid-July, as we move into August? So for me, I would like to look at what kind of feedback was solicited, how it was solicited, the timing in which ideas and were proposed to the Silly Market, because a lot of times you can't add ideas midstream. So at this point, I can't tell you that someone's right and someone's wrong, but for me, a consistency of process and a transparency of how it works is going to be able to clear up that situation and be able to really find out what the issue is.
Yeah. Now, you were around when we started talking about paid parking. It has since been instituted while you were away. Have you heard from merchants about that? How has that worked for them?
So, absolutely. I have been hearing a lot about paid parking. I think the biggest voice that I've been hearing from the merchants is about employee parking. And that was, of course, one of the biggest issues that we wanted to talk about as we were looking at an implementation plan. With that, you know, what are we doing for employees? How are employees still getting into town? If we are putting them in a park and ride, what's that frequency? What's the duration of that? How many cars can we place? Again, I feel like half the solution's in place, but not the full solution. So while paid parking acts as a stick, it's a detriment or it's a deterrent to be able to park here, and that's the hope, is to be able to deter people to park here, but that they then take transit. Is transit at that level where we can solidly rely on that for employee transportation? Is it at a frequency? Is it at a location that doesn't add an exorbitant amount of time to that employee's commute time into the district? So in my mind, that is a piece that I want to look at and see how it is working. What modifications can we put into place for this winter? And again, what are those long-term pieces we need to do? The city's not going to change their mind about how they manage this. So what we have to do is make sure that there's a full system in place.
Yeah. What do we know about the Homestake lot? We did away with it for the summer season. Is it coming back? Do we know?
My goal is for it to come back. I don't believe that there's imminent development plans over the winter for that. So I hope that we can retain that throughout the entire winter. But I have a meeting next week with transportation to be able to start to understand that better.
Yeah, because at one point, I think we were offering like every 10-minute shuttles to the transit center. That many times just empty,
right?
You know, empty buses. So that's not effective either.
No, and it's, you know, I had done a trial program using the school lots about 6 years ago. That we didn't have ridership on either. I don't know where we are able to see success on this yet. And again, is it because we don't have all the elements in place, or is it because there's other areas where people can park? And is that still okay? I don't know.
Yeah. And it sounds like that may be part of the solution, though. I mean, working more with the schools once that Homestake lot is developed.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. I mean, at this point, they're the largest parking area closest to Main Street, but it doesn't mean they don't come with their own set of issues as well as restrictions on dates and times.
Sure. Sundance, and of course, and well, you know, when the Eccles Center is
absolutely
booked.
And yeah. other yeah school events.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. What other issues have you got kind of on your agenda for the organization?
Oh, exciting! Trash and recycling. The contract that we have with Republic Services expires November 30th, and I've been working on a long-term waste management plan for Main Street. And that's actually a project I had started back in May for the city. And so that's been completed as far as a report. And now we'll be going out for RFQs once City Council reviews kind of the report and the process. But really looking at how can we manage our waste better on Main Street? How can we increase the amount that we recycle? What are those items we need to be recycling in order to see the greatest benefit, whether that be environmental or diversion of waste to the landfill?
Yeah, so what does your report recommend? I mean,
our biggest recyclables that are in our dumpsters are cardboard, plastic, and food waste. And if you were to, or if we were to able to find an alternate disposal method, whether that be composting or whatnot, not only would we be diverting that, but we would also be reducing the weight of our waste, which then will reduce our price. So trying to find that economic piece of it, and not just, well, and also the environmental piece. How can we be better stewards to the earth? So those are two pieces that we're putting together, and definitely knowing that not every business benefits from food waste. So how do we look at a payment scale on that, and how does that work? So there's a lot of little pieces that we are going to need to refine. But I think overall, we're taking some great steps to be able to really take some strides in the way of reducing our waste.
Yeah. Is that how it's done now? I mean, everybody pays the same fee?
Right now, there's the common dumpsters in Sweet Alley, and so majority of the businesses on the east side of the street, so the post office side of the street, use those. The west side of the street, because they don't have a back alley, they're backed up against residential on Park Avenue. Most of them have toter cans, just like we have residential, and they pull those in and out of their front doors every night. You also have businesses like at Marriott Summit Watch and down by Town Lift that have their own dumpsters. So there's three different services that trash is provided on Main Street, but it's all underneath one contract. And so that one contract is with a waste disposal company. And then as well, we would have other contracts with recycling companies too.
So trash is picked up every day on Main Street?
It depends on the time of season. We do fluctuate depending on the need.
Okay. Any other issues that you wanted to bring up?
You know, those are the big ones, but definitely I'm excited to be back here and working with the merchants again.
Okay. Allison, congratulations on that. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, the Park City Council met yesterday to discuss special service contracts, a lot line amendment that led to a conversation about historic preservation and more. Here with a recap, I have Councilmember Steve Joyce. Good morning.
Good morning.
So during council comments, you mentioned that you had attended a regional water meeting where you received a presentation on the Weber Basin Drought Management Plan. You said water is going to continue to be a huge issue for us. What did you learn that alarmed you?
I guess it's not a surprise for the people who have any kind of belief in climate change. It's they went back and did a historical look at when the driest times were in the state. This is across really the Weber Basin, but that's a good chunk of this part of the state, and found how many times they thought it would have dropped down into their really kind of extreme drought kind of areas. And there were periods, but it wasn't that frequent. But when you start adding our growth rates and start adding the warming temperatures and start adding the more extreme weather patterns, the lower snowpack, we're going to have a lot of times where, you know, we're going to be either in drought or extreme drought kinds of situations. And when you look at it, it's not like there's just more water to go get. It's, you know, we have what we have and the reservoirs are pretty much there. It would be really, really, really difficult to ever go build another reservoir somewhere. And so I think it's really going to come down to water consumption, and we're just going to have to change behaviors. And Park City, I think, is ahead of the game with that, with the way we changed our rates. That kind of drove down some of the utilization and growth, but we've got a long ways to go.
Yeah, there had been talk years ago, though, about another reservoir, perhaps in Round Valley. Is that still in the books? I mean, and then we've also talked about a pipeline that would come up from East Canyon.
There's possibilities. All of those things are extraordinarily expensive. I mean, they're in the $100 million kind of ballpark. I've seen the, you know, projections, because that's actually part of what we end up doing with Mountain Regional, Summit Water, Park City Water, doing these interconnects so we can share water, is to avoid having to do one of these monster projects. But even when you look at like the Round Valley Reservoir, the amount of water they were talking about having in there compared to something like Jordanelle or Rockport or something like that, I mean, it's a drop. It's nothing. So, I mean, you need one of these, you know, big 300, 400-foot dams again to really make a difference.
Mm. Leadership Park City Class 25 gave their presentation on wildland fires and defensible space. Has the city made progress there on that?
We're getting there. Bruce Erickson is kind of driving a focus mostly aimed at the open space that we own. You know, we really haven't been doing what I would call forestry management or wildfire management of the space. And, you know, if you look up at Treasure Hill that we just bought, there's a bunch of dead trees up in there. And, boy, it comes right down into town. And so, you know, we're starting to look at what it would take and, you know, what we could, I expect they're going to bring us back some plans, and everything we hear is, wow, it's really expensive to go up there and try to manage this property. It's not like we can do what the Forest Service is doing and, you know, go start some wildfires or something and let it burn out.
Do we have a budget, though, to do something like that?
I mean, we don't. We don't today. Hmm. So, I mean, we have a small budget for open space management, and that's mostly geared towards, you know, trails and dealing with people who, you know, kind of, you know, step into the open space in ways they shouldn't. So,
yeah. And as a result of kind of the Class 25's efforts, are we seeing more homeowners kind of trimming up their trees and creating those defensible spaces?
You know, it sounds like they talk to a lot of people. I really don't know. I got to be one of the ones that they came out and did the little filming with, where we had one of the fire wardens come out and look at my condo that I live in. And so I can tell you, I cut down some trees, and then I turned around and used the fire department's, you know, come collect your branches kind of things, which I think that's mostly house owners. But as a condo owner, I'm like, hey, I back right up to the Gamble Oak property, and that's, you know, those scrub oaks just catch fire. They're always half dead anyway. And so I know I've been making a change just based on what the class did.
Great. Let's see. Council also voted to pull the contract for the Ride Amigos app off the consent agenda. This is, we're talking about a $25,000 a year contract for up to 3 years. Your main point, Steve, was that this is another traffic reduction strategy where you don't know if it will actually be effective. And you said this isn't the first time that you've told transportation staff that you want to see measurable results of these different kinds of strategies. Alfred Knotts, our transportation director, says that there are lots of strategies and it's hard to measure results. So is that an answer you're comfortable with?
I think we're getting there. I'll give these guys credit. I mean, I'm one of Alfred's kind of thorns in his side, but I'm also one of his biggest fans. The transit organization has done a phenomenal job of getting much, much better information about who's riding the buses, where they're coming from, where they're going to, and how the ridership is changing. And that's allowing us to better manage the system. And what I'm asking is, in the same way that they've kind of made those changes over the last year or two, all these other things we talk about, anything from, you know, dial a ride to, you know, the employee shuttle. I just heard you talking about that as I was driving here. You know, all those things, it's like they sound like good ideas. And the question is, yeah, but are they? And are they being effective? And maybe it's a good idea, but you're not promoting it, marketing it enough. So to me, everything we do like this should have measurable objectives. I think you got the message. We still ended up passing this last night, so it's going to go into play. But I think over time, the same kinds of numbers and things we see on the transit, the actual bus system, I think we'll start to see that on most of our projects that we do.
Yeah, I think you voted against it, though, didn't you?
I did. Yeah. I did. And it wasn't against the idea of Ride Amigos and the app and what they're doing. I love the fact that they're starting to partner with the ski resorts and the big employers in town. I think that's a huge step up from a community standpoint. It's just, hey, I want to know when we get to the end of the year and you ask us for the next $25,000, did it work? Did it meet the expectations? And are we really making an impact?
So is it now the city's responsibility to encourage people to use the app, or large employers to make sure that their staffs are using the app?
It's actually going to be pushed back mostly to the employer. So this is a, you know, a financial partnership between both the employers and the city. But the employers are really the ones who are going to try to set up whether they want to do carpooling or van sharing, or, you know, what kind of, you know, park and ride, what kind of mechanism they want to use in this. A really flexible application. There's a, they used it in Austin, Texas, and there's a, you know, kind of a great case study out there. It was really had a big impact.
So can I download it now, or no, the contract's not?
No, the contract's not in place yet.
Okay. You did hear from somebody during public comment, though, from about the lack of transit to the IHC area. And of course, now with the opening of the Peace House, does that need to change? And I'll bring Alfred in when I can get him in. But yeah, that's kind of hard.
I think it's going to. It's one of these things where you kind of struggle with you want to provide service to areas, but it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. It's like, you know, at the same time, our bus system is expensive, especially for a town this size. So when you start talking about running a bus into there, if you're only going to get one or two riders a day kind of thing, it's not worth it. But at the same time, you're not going to get any riders until you start doing it. So we do have a dial-and-ride service out there, Dial-A-Ride, that services not only the hospital, but all the little places along the way, including the Peace House. So we do have service.
Okay, so that's not, the Dial-A-Ride is not just for seniors or maybe disabled folks? It's for anybody?
Yeah. Well, it is for that service area. So again, if you just wanted to go from, you know, your house in Prospector to KPCW in the morning, no, you couldn't call and get a Dial-A-Ride. But it, you know, if you want to get to or from the hospital area, then in fact that is the transit solution, is to call for a ride.
Okay. You know, I had asked Assistant City Manager Matt Dias earlier this week if the city council should be recommending to the resorts whether or not they should follow Solitude's lead and just institute paid parking. How do you feel about that?
I know people are going to hate me for this, but I'm actually a big fan of paid parking. I think that's got to be part of the solution. And you see it. There's just such a behavior here of, and I'm part of it. It's like if I'm going to go meet three of my friends and go ski with them at Deer Valley or Park City, we'll probably all drive separately, even if we live a mile apart from the furthest to the closest kind of thing. We'll all drive separately because it's free. It's convenient. It's more flexible. There's no downside to it. But if all of a sudden it was $10 or $20 or something, or you do what Solitude's done, and the more people you have in the car, the cheaper it is, I think behavior would change instantly. Now, some people go, oh, it's for the rich people and they can still drive. Yeah, okay, it's not gonna influence everybody. But I think it would have a big impact. And we still, I mean, when you look at what happened this winter at both resorts, I mean, they were overflowing the parking lots frequently. And it's not just a parking thing. It's even if they had parking for all this, it clogs up the roads. I mean, we have these little corridors like Deer Valley Drive, and that screws up our transit system. All of a sudden, traffic backs up, and now the buses don't run on time. So
have we figured out what we're going to do this winter with Deer Valley and overflow parking?
Yeah, I think that got resolved with the Planning Commission, which is, I think they're building, 80 to 100 spaces. And I think there's a couple of things that we're going to do. So basically, they still have the right to park out on the street as the original planning agreement was, but it's going to be capped at the roughly 11 days during the year. And I think part of it's also just things like snow management. I mean, I know they lost a bunch of parking spaces to big piles of snow, and they either could have hauled it out or been a little bit more careful about where they're putting it. But of course, you don't know you're going to have a big year until you had one.
All right. You and Councilmember Nan Worrell worked to develop the categories for the next round of special service contracts, housing, education, inclusion, and workforce development. Those first three were from the top three areas of focus in the Park City Community Foundation's Social Equity Strategic Plan. So how did you and Nan come to the last one, workforce development?
I think I kind of started it, and then we all kind of moved that direction. It was actually one of the strategic, the social equity strategic plan had six areas that were focuses. The workforce development was one of them, but it just didn't quite make the top of their list. I get a little frustrated sometimes when we're looking at how we're helping people in the community, And there's, it's the old, you know, teach a man to fish versus give him a fish kind of thing, where it's one thing to help you, you know, get a ride to school or something like that. But at some level, it really comes down to me to a base thing that says, if you don't make enough money to really live well, I'll say, in this community, you're going to be fighting uphill forever. And so I got a little frustrated. I want to find some things we can do to kind of help people move up the ladder, move up the pay scale. And I'd heard some good ideas that were kind of floating around out there, and I didn't want to lose those, even though the Community Foundation has a lot more work to go do on this.
Are there any organizations or services that you had in mind when making the categories, or do you think that there's going to be some applicants out there that...
Yes, I know there's some ideas that will come in, and I really don't want to speak for them because we haven't, you know, I'm sure as an organization, they've got a board and everything to talk to about before they start bringing in new programs.
Okay. Finally, I wanted to ask you about the proponents of historic preservation showed up last night to speak out against the lot line adjustment for the Nakoma condominium project within the Empire Pass development. They argue that this is one of the many projects that should have to meet historic preservation requirements as outlined by the Flagstaff Development Agreement from 20 years ago. I think the council went ahead and allowed that lot line adjustment to be happen.
We
How
did.
How come?
There's two things. There's really kind of a split between the legal decision that we had to make last night, which was a land use decision, and a policy decision. Quite honestly, if you go back, the Flagstaff Agreement had a lot of good things in for historic preservation when it was done 20 years ago. And quite frankly, the city, the community, we dropped the ball. A lot of the stuff wasn't enforced. The time to really be holding, I mean, there were actual triggers in place that were, you know, the first CUP 20 years ago or something where things should have been held up. They weren't. And then they weren't, and they weren't, and they weren't, and they weren't. And so now it's really getting difficult. And so when we get something coming in last night, they had no historic things on their land that needed to be preserved. You really couldn't hold this particular developer or this particular lot owner responsible. So, but different than that, I really appreciate, I think we all appreciate the fact that the museum, the friends of the museum are coming out and keeping this in front of us and continuing to drive our work that we're doing with not only developers up there, but also the Master Association for Empire Pass.
Yeah, well, you said it was a legal versus policy decision, but isn't the Flagstaff Development Agreement a legal document?
It is, but the problem is a lot of the argument that we heard last night was, yes, that's a legal document, but it wasn't, and here's how to apply that legal document to this particular case and make it stick. It was, hey, there was this legal document a long time ago, and your policy should be, it's just, you know, you really needed to look at this particular application and see whether it held or not, and it didn't.
So how will the city then work to, as Councilmember Nan Worrell put it, put more teeth into its agreements?
The good news is we've done that. I mean, we've learned some lessons along the way. There's a couple of things that have already happened. One is, like you see the same kind of thing that came up last night, that Park City Mountain Resort had an affordable housing commitment that was never met. You know, we've had a couple of things where we would put conditions of approval and planning commission things and they wouldn't get followed through. To her credit, Anne Laurent and her team between building, planning, and engineering have really put in a much, much better tracking process in place so they really can follow things through the steps. I think it's getting better, but that doesn't really help us with, you know, what happened 20 years ago. We've kind of just got to make the most of it.
Okay. Anything else, Steve, you wanted to mention?
No, that's it. Thanks.
Thank you. That's Park City Council member Steve Joyce. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:52. Good morning. Well, the Semi-County Council this year increased the annual solid waste fee. In the studio to tell us why and how those revenues will be spent, I have Semi-County Landfill Superintendent Tim Loveday. Good morning.
Good morning.
So this annual fee went into effect back in 2016. It was $36 through last year. The fee went up to $40. How come?
Well, we're seeing a steady increase each year in the cost of disposal of solid waste. Our collections contract goes up according to the Consumer Price Index for garbage each year. And so we're seeing an increase there each year. So finally the fee had to catch up with that.
Yeah. So why a separate fee, though? Why isn't this just pulled out of the general fund?
You know, most of it is pulled out of the general fund. Right now, I know people get a little upset sometimes about that fee, but that amounts to about $650,000 that the county takes in on that fee each year. The actual cost of the collections program for the county is $2.8 million. So, you know, the fee is nowhere near covering that. It's still being subsidized out of general fund.
Okay. So does this then make sure that it pays its full cost then?
Well, it gets the full cost is paid, but only because it is subsidized by general fund. You know, if we were ever in a situation like a lot of the municipalities down in the valley where they charge, you know, garbage based on or recycling based on what it actually costs, you know, then you're looking at fees that run north of $200, $250 a year.
Okay. So again, this is just kind of the inflationary increased contract
yes.
cost. How much more did that raise then, adding another $4 to each
well,
customer?
I'd have to calculate that out. We have about 17,000 residents that pay that fee. So, okay.
Are you seeing a better response in terms of people paying the fee than you did when you first started it?
We are. You know, the first year that we rolled that out, and you know, frankly, we didn't do a very good job at rolling that out initially. It was the wrong time of year, and we were running late. You know, we had about 3,600 complaints that first year. This year, you know, we're getting complaints, but mostly it's complaints from individuals who have been missed the last couple of years because we have wrong addresses or P.O. boxes that don't work, you know, or out-of-state owners, that kind of thing. But overall, it's been very positive.
Yeah. In terms of people not paying, have you had to stop traffic collection because of non-payment?
Non-payment will result in your cans being pulled. We haven't had to do very much of that. Most of the people that we've had that are non-paying tend to be up in the cabin communities where they're already accessing a dumpster. We can't pull that dumpster because we have 4,000 other people using that same dumpster. But so far, you know, we haven't had to be too aggressive on that.
Okay. And then payment gets your can back?
Payment gets your can back, but you'll pay a fee to get that can back. So
okay. Let's see. And again, part of this is paying for the cost of just taking care of our garbage. The county did open its new garbage cell and close the old one this year?
Yes, we did. We opened the new cell. We didn't close the old one. It's still there, and we'll work on that over the next few years. There's actually some more garbage that will go up there ultimately as we fill the new cell. It overlaps onto the old one, so we've got to reach those closure elevations before we actually close that existing cell. But we are in the new line cell. We're producing leachate with the rains we've had in recent weeks, so we're busy managing that and building a leachate evaporation system. But overall, the new cell is going very, very well.
So what do you mean when you're producing leachate?
That's rainwater that infiltrates through the garbage. Once that's come into the cell, any rain that falls on that cell footprint gets contaminated because it touches garbage. And then we term it as leachate because it goes through that garbage and leaches chemicals and bacteria and everything else. So we have to take that to a pond to manage it. The best way for us to manage that and the most cost effective is to evaporate it. So that's what we're doing is putting the evaporation system in. That was planned all along. And then if the evaporation system can't keep up, we'll pump it back up onto the waste and recirculate it through the waste, which helps that waste decay, creates more airspace for the landfill. And then if neither of those can keep up, if we had a really bad winter or a really bad storm series, then from there we would tank it and take it to a wastewater treatment plant.
So it sounds like it's even more expensive then to take care of garbage just because of the because we're trying to protect the groundwater, right? That's why we put the lining in, and that's causing more.
You're exactly right. You know, the new cell, while it's environmentally friendly and meets the current, you know, the latest regulations, you know, that new cell cost us an additional $1.2 million over what it would have been if we had an unlined cell. So the cost of disposing of garbage in the county and, you know, across the country is going up exponentially.
I want to spend the last couple of minutes we have talking about the fact that the county council earlier this month held their first discussion about banning single-use plastic bags. You presented some data to the council suggesting that as a landfill supervisor, they're not that big of a deal for you. They're small. I mean, it sounds like you spend a lot of time chasing them as they blow on the wind. But this is something you're encouraging the council not to do, or?
And no, I by no means am encouraging the council not to do a bag ban. I just, I'm a data guy. I'm a geologist. I like things done based on scientific fact. And I think there's a lot of misinformation on both sides out there over plastic bags. I've made no secret to the county since I was hired that my number one priority at that landfill is diversion, because I want to create more airspace and make it last longer for the county. That's where the county gets its value from that landfill. Plastic bags are an absolute pain. I wish people didn't use them. I try not to use them myself. I even recently, well, just last week, I was at Subway, and I asked them not to put it in a plastic bag. Just hand me the sandwich. I don't need that extra plastic bag. And they looked at me like I was crazy, but, you know, that's one more bag that doesn't go to the landfill. On a volume basis, they take up about a nine foot by nine foot cube of space in that landfill each year, which is basically nothing. But they are an absolute pain to deal with from a management standpoint. On the positive, we have Mary Clouser and a group of kids that were there at the council meeting, and they've been working very, very hard. They've come up to the landfill to visit me several times, and they came up, you know, with a bag ban really kind of on their own, and that's what they've been pushing. And I know they left that council meeting kind of feeling defeated, but they need to know they actually did a very, very good job, because we're talking about it, and that's what we really need to do. If we're going to change the way we recycle and do a better job at protecting the environment, it starts with a conversation.
Yeah, so if people aren't using their own bags, they're going to take one of the paper bags, and that's your concern, is because that's going to fill up the landfill much faster, and what, they don't decompose?
Yeah, I'm much more concerned about paper bags, frankly, than I am plastic bags. Paper bags take up a lot more space in the landfill. There have been scientific studies done that show that that if you ban plastic bags and then push towards paper bags, and that's what replaces the plastic bags, that your cost of landfill management goes up about 700%. It's a pretty significant difference.
Yeah. So I guess what we've learned from paid parking here in Park City is that if you have to pay for it, you know, like charging people for plastic bags or paper bags, that maybe they'll look at alternatives?
Yeah, you know, my personal opinion, I can't speak for council or what the county might ultimately do down the road, but from the studies I'm seeing, we're seeing more success over charging for a plastic bag than we are by banning them outright. And that changes the motivation of people to where they not only do a better job with their plastic bags, but they start thinking about the environmental consequences of things they do across the board.
Finally, I just want to mention that Recycle Utah has its Fall Dumpster Days coming up this weekend and next. I mean, how does that help you with the work you do there at the landfill?
Well, the Dumpster Days diverts a lot of larger items that the individual residents would have to bring out themselves. So, you know, as far as diversion, it doesn't necessarily help us. That's more a service to the public.
Yeah. And does it then, though, take away funds, though? I mean, otherwise people would pay to dump the stuff?
You know, technically, I guess they would be paying a tipping fee for that, you know, whereas the county takes it from Recycle Utah for free. But in the overall scheme of things, it's a convenience issue because it's not that much tonnage.
Yeah. In terms of the tipping fees, how have those kind of played out over the few years? Because I know that the former director of Recycle Utah was something that she was really pushing for. I mean, it was like if it becomes, again, if it hits our pocketbook, we change behavior.
She was right. The tipping fees in Utah, we have the second lowest tipping fees in the nation as a state. They're incredibly low. And, you know, right now at $35 a ton, it's frankly cheaper to dispose of your waste rather than try to do something else or to curb it. Until we see a financial driver there, I don't think we're going to see a whole lot of change.
And I guess the reality is if the county did increase its tipping fees, the garbage provider would then just increase the contract price. That would cost us all more anyway, right?
Yeah, those costs are passed straight through to the customer. You can't kid yourself about that. And, you know, additionally, we would see if it wasn't done statewide and only Summit County raised their fees, then you'll see some of that waste being transported off to other jurisdictions. And that sounds good on the surface, but then that means less revenue coming into the landfill and makes our cost per ton go up even more. So that would be passed directly onto the citizen.
Yeah. Does Summit County accept trash from anybody else?
We technically do. If you're out of the county, like we occasionally get something in from Wasatch County, Midway type area, but you're going to get charged 2.5 times the normal rate because our landfill is subsidized by taxpayer revenue. So, and, you know, instead of 35, you're going to be paying, you know, 2.5 times 35 to dispose of that. I think we have consistently 2 customers that do that, and they both go to the Hennifer landfill. But, you know, even though they're out of the county, they're paying so much that we welcome them there at that point.
Yeah. And then we do have a second landfill, and that's used mainly for construction debris.
Yes, that's the Hennifer landfill. That's construction, demolition, and debris. In fact, we just renewed the permit on that landfill. It's gone now. We didn't change the footprint out there, but we did go and combine up different cells. So it had a life left of about 5 years, and under the new permit, we've got about 30 years of life there without expanding the footprint. So yeah. Good news there.
And have we seen a difference, I mean, with Recycle Utah and the Habitat for Humanity Restore kind of taking some of these, you know, projects that are being demolished and kind of reusing those? Has that made a difference to what's going there?
Yeah, I think they're doing a good job on that type thing, you know. And there's a lot of things that go on at Recycle Utah that, you know, the general public doesn't really think about. You know, a small one would be like styrofoam recycling that the county just simply can't do. Recycle Utah does between 6 and 7 tons a year of styrofoam, and it doesn't sound like that much. But if you took that styrofoam in at our, across our scale, and we were charging tip fees for it, it's only about $217 worth of tip fees. But that same styrofoam, because it's so light, takes up almost $4,000 worth of airspace. Habitat, Recycle Utah, and other organizations as well have done a really good job at helping us divert. Essentially, with Recycle Utah, the county's helped support Recycle Utah. We donate about $85,000 a year to that nonprofit. For that $85,000, I'm getting basically a $500,000 a year group of people working for me. They've really become the ninth man on our field to help support the efforts that we do. They've done a great job. I think even more important than the diversion of waste is their household hazardous waste collection days. If the Rotary and Recycle Utah and others didn't do that, the county would have to pick up that. And the tab alone on that for labor and disposal will be over $100,000. So pretty happy with our partner there. We think they've done a really good job.
So finally, what are the plans then for a new center for Recycle Utah? Because I know the city's anxious to get into that spot where they're at.
Yeah, I know. I'm feeling the pressure from them. I sit on their board as a county liaison, so that's a monthly discussion we have. You know, it's still up in the air. I think that ultimately the county will provide some assistance there, but the timing on that's going to be quite complicated because you got to find property, and property within the basin, because we got to keep Recycle Utah close to Park City or it's just simply not going to work. And trying to locate property and secure that, get everything approved, is a time-consuming process.
So we still don't have a location?
Not an official one.
Okay. Tim, thanks.